Welcome to the Reimagining Podcast with Theodore Richards. The Reimagining Podcast is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated, a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which includes the Baltimore Wisdom Project and the Chicago Wisdom Project. Our shared mission is to reimagine education and reimagine the world by enhancing the lives of youth and adults with holistic education, intercultural understanding, and anti-oppressive, liberationist thought leadership.
From the melting polar caps to violence in our cities to the rise of fascist governments, ours is an age in which we seem to be able to agree on almost nothing except that we are all in crisis. It would be easy to think of the rising anxiety I'm feeling as something different from the rising sea levels, or to think of the migrant crisis as at odds with the violence in our inner cities. But at the core, all of our crises actually share some of the same roots, and part of the healing process individually involves getting to those roots collectively. How can we be hopeful when news of our demise comes on the television every night? How can we learn to share our resources when we're told we can only find meaning by consuming more and more? Most significantly, how can we live as though the planet itself is a single interconnected community when we've been told that our purpose is to find only individual success, only individual salvation? I'm going to suggest that our spiritual malaise, the loneliness and loss of meaning, is connected to our ecological, political, and economic crises. It's all connected, and it's all about the deep story we tell about who we are and our place in the world. Let me explain. There's something in the air as thick and unmistakable as the CO2 particulates, even if it isn't as easily quantified. All around us, there's an anxiety about our future, about the future of our children. And like climate change, this anxiety is so massive, so all-encompassing and consuming, that it feels impossible to escape, impossible to deal with. We also live in an age of anger, an age of fear, but of all the emotions that dominate our age, I'm suggesting that loneliness is the most pervasive. It is loneliness that tortures the mass shooter or the Wall Street executive who never seems to have enough. It is loneliness that leads us to addictions, to shopping, food, or anti-anxiety meds. In some ways, this is my own greatest fear, and perhaps that which we all fear, being alone, really alone. I've often suggested that this is the ultimate salvation we are all seeking, true communion, connection, far more than any lonely, segregated paradise. Why are we lonely? The reasons are complex and have to do with the habits and lifestyles of the modern world. We surround ourselves with less family and community, we spend more time staring at screens, but our loneliness begins with a story about who we are on the most fundamental level. This story tells us that our deepest identity is individual and that we need to buy our way into a meaningful life. Charles Eisenstein is an essayist, speaker, and the author of several books, including Sacred Economics, Climate, A New Story, and The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible. Charles Eisenstein, welcome to Reimagining.
Hi, Theodore. Happy to be with you.
So I wanted to start this question. You know, we're talking about environmentalism. And I think that so often when we have this conversation about environmentalism, we jump right into inputs and outputs and levels of particulates in the atmosphere. I wanted to start by just talking about language. And I wanted to have this conversation about what are the words we're using? And we use words like environment and nature, even earth. And there are certain assumptions we make about what those might mean, but those are actually, I would argue that those are actually metaphors for bigger concepts that are really hard for most of us to really even conceptualize. And they're complex ideas that are embedded in stories and cultural contexts. So I guess I wanted to start by asking you to reflect a little bit on the role of language when we have this conversation about environmentalism and what kind of assumptions we're making when we use the word environment or earth or nature. And perhaps maybe then what we might ought to consider a little bit more deeply before we begin to think that we can even solve such a problem as climate change.
Yeah, well, I think that we can learn a lot about our perceptions and our beliefs by looking at the words that we use. And I'm also a little cautious about getting too fundamentalistic about words and the idea that if we only could change the way that we speak and use the politically correct or ecologically correct language, then everything changes. And because it can become this almost inquisition. Mm-hmm. So I do think words are powerful, and they are powerful as gateways to attitudes and beliefs. So for example, the word environment, environmentalism, you could definitely make a critique of that and say, that part of the whole problem is that we don't see ourselves as embedded within and part of nature, but we see it as something that merely surrounds us or is around, or, you know, it's our environment. And like, okay, valid criticism. And environmentalism has, or environment has come to take on a meaning that is quite distant from its origins. Same thing with sustainability. Like, I kind of like to use that word in order to invite an inquiry into the question, what do we want to, quote, sustain? Do we want to sustain the world that we're living in right now? Maybe we should ask another question instead of how do we sustain the status quo? What world do we want to create? Like, so sustainability can be, and in fact, actually the word was coined as something that would be more acceptable to people who would otherwise be hostile to environmentalism. Oh, it's like the scientific thing about sustainability. That word is a gateway to an inquiry. Does that mean that I never use the word sustainability? No, because it communicates, but I do like to invite that kind of conversation.
It's often used in the context of, you know, I've seen it particularly in the so-called developing world. We talk about sustainable development, which sometimes is sort of like, it's a way to kind of play both sides a little bit and suggest that we're being green, but also having people enter into a bigger kind of capitalist order in the process,
right,
by developing. Yeah, for sure. So let's shift a little bit, but I'm curious about how you see like some of the language that we use today and what kind of assumptions are embedded in that language that are not just in the language itself, because I think you make a great point that I think a lot of the conversation that you see, you know, like if you were to say, go on Twitter or somewhere, you'd see a lot of conversation about that. It really is like hyper-focused on using the right language all the time. I think sometimes can be an impediment to actual change in action. What is some language that you see or ways of thinking, let's say, about climate and about the earth and about nature? What are some of the assumptions you see that you see as being an impediment to actual change and actual, and in, yeah, in the process of creating this a world that we might want?
So one of the habits of our civilization is to, when we talk about being realistic or being practical or being scientific, what that means is that you operate in the realm of numbers. Mm-hmm. So this is, it's not just words we're talking about here, it's numbers. And the practical approach to something is you take some measurements, you adopt a policy according to how it will affect those measurements. You make models, you do things by the numbers. So in the area of environmentalism, a scientific practical approach would be that you calculate the carbon footprint of this, that, and the other thing, and you operate this max min problem to, you know, minimize emissions and maximize sequestration and so forth. And that's how you decide policy or even your personal choices. And an unscientific approach would be something like, I don't care about the carbon impact. I want to save this whale. I want to save this forest. And then someone says, well, it's okay to cut down this forest because we'll offset it with another forest somewhere else. And you're like, that just doesn't do it for me. You're sourcing from another impulse. And I think that the surrender of that impulse and the obsession with numbers and the equation that we see today of green with low carbon and sustainability with a zero carbon future is a huge strategic error on the part of environmentalists. I understand where it comes from. It's like, because I remember, you know, I've been an environmentalist since, gosh, I'm like getting old now, like since before a lot of people listening were born, probably.
Yeah.
Been an environmentalist since I was 8 years old, okay? And I remember back in the day, environmentalism wasn't that practical. And when we said, let's save the whales or let's save the great horned owl, it wasn't because if we don't do it, bad things will happen to us. There wasn't that kind of self-interested practical reason. It was because the whales are magnificent, because they're beautiful, because we love them. And then around, I would say like the mid or late 80s, the narrative changed. And it was because now we have to stop fossil fuel production, because if we don't, the climate is going to warm and we'll have catastrophe. And so now we've got a practical reason. Now we have a way to appeal to the people who actually don't care about life on Earth. We have a way to appeal to people's self-interest instead of having to appeal to their love. And I think that this is a huge mistake. For one thing, it's dishonest, because I know, at least I am not an environmentalist because of all the money I'll save or the bad consequences to myself that I will avoid. I'm an environmentalist because I love this earth. Anyway, that's one. I don't want to go on too long. I could probably go on for a whole hour about.
Yeah. What's interesting about what you're saying, I think, is that it's certainly not even limited to the question of the environment. It's entirely the same, I think, mistaken approach that we take to the way we, and I think this is related to how we got there. It's the same approach that we might take to many areas of human endeavor in our civilization. For example, in education, it's like the way we think that if we can quantify it, then it becomes somehow more real, right?
Yeah, and then you end up with national testing and standards.
Exactly, and that becomes the focus. And there is a place for quantification. I'm not suggesting that we never ought to take a test, and it'll show you certain things. Right. But the problem comes in when we center the entire curriculum, or to use a broader example, an entire civilization around that, which is quantifiable. And then we're only able to kind of see the things that are very much that we can quantify. It's interesting that you brought up science, because it's in some ways that becomes like an idol almost, the quantifiable, right? It becomes like has almost mystical quality that's not actually more scientific. It simply is this, it's imbued with more power because we can count it and calculate it and give it a number.
Yeah, that's the one of the primary metaphysical assumptions of civilization and certainly of science, which is that if you can count it, if you can measure it, then it's real. In science, if you can't count it or measure it, if it's intangible, if it's qualitative, then you can't do science on it. So the problem, of course, is that, as you kind of said, what gets left out when you navigate the world on the numbers is all the things that are unmeasurable, or that you have trouble measuring, or that you decide are not worth measuring. And we can see basically on the social, political, economic level, it manifests as the people who just don't count, the people who are marginalized, the people who may not make a large contribution to GDP, and therefore their lives are devalued, and they live in poverty and hopelessness and misery and end up in prison, like these throwaway people, that ultimately comes down in large part to the things that our society chooses not to consider important enough to measure, or that are fundamentally hard to measure. Like, how do you measure the value of a relationship? How do you measure the value of a connection to a place? How do you measure the value of community? I heard a beautiful story today of an intervention in Oakland, I think it was, where there was a street altercation. There was a man, a shopkeeper, accusing an African-American man of stealing from his store, and he did not denied it, and it was escalating. But before anyone could call the police, some citizens intervened and de-escalated it and held a circle and gave him hugs and heard his story. And that kind of activity is largely invisible to our systems of power, to our economic system. No one gets paid for that. So what I'm trying to say here is that the general principle that maybe is a healing principle for our world is, what is getting left out? Who is getting left out? What are the beings that are getting left out with carbon accountancy? When you convert Africa into biofuels plantations in order to bring down official carbon numbers, what is sacrificed? And in my ecological writing, what I concluded is that not only are people and species and biodiversity sacrificed, but it is even worse for the climate. Whatever the superficial carbon numbers say, when you destroy whole organs of the living being that we call Earth, then everything spins out of control and we go into organ failure.
Thinking about as you're sharing the story about the episode in Oakland and then also the story about Africa, is that it feels like one of the things, and it's sort of like one of the core, what you described in Oakland was sort of a restorative process, right? Like it was rather than a punitive process, it was a restorative yes. process. And one of the basic principles of restorative work, as with ecology, is that, and this is a really hard kind of shift for us to make given the basic assumptions of our civilization, is that what is primary is relationship. That's what you're doing in restorative work. You're restoring the relationship. And the thinking about, say, if we're thinking only in terms of the quantity of a thing that's released into the atmosphere and can be measured, we're not thinking about relationship there. What we're thinking about is just the things in between those relationships, but not how the actual relationships are functioning. And that's, I think, true with human relationships or relationships among the entire living planet.
Yes.
Just as an example of a way that we might shift from a way of thinking. And another thing I think that's kind of useful to consider is that you're talking about love and how one might have this like feeling of love or affinity or taking in the kind of beauty of the earth, right, in that relationship. And I want to consider or ask you how we make a false distinction between this our inner lives, right, the feelings we might have, our emotional lives, and the kind of like relationships, the physical relationships on the planet. I wonder what you think about that idea that we have, that our way of thinking about our emotional lives, our feelings, are considered to be an entirely separate realm, let's say, from the kind of relationships between living species on the planet. Is that another kind of like obstacle we have to think through this?
So that gets down to a core tenet of the mythology that we live in. Part of that mythology, and by mythology, I mean something that answers the basic questions that a human being asks.
Right.
Like, why am I here? Who am I? What's real? What's important? Right. Part of that mythology says that you are a separate individual, and therefore that what goes on inside of yourself has no necessary direct connection to what's happening in the world, and vice versa. And that what's happening in the world, you could insulate yourself from that. Because it's fundamentally separate from you. That's part of the implication of the word environment, actually. So I'll just say, like, most cultures did not, and to a large extent do not, agree that there's this separation between the inner and the outer. But they understood that the state of the planet, even the state of the cosmos, is related to the state of the human heart and is related to the state of human society. And therefore, there's many implications of that. One is that our felt sense of significance and importance when we do a small act in service, and it feels big, even though the rational mind is like, well, you just planted one little garden. What does that matter in the face of global climate change? Or you just de-escalated one conflict. What does that matter in the context of police violence and the prison industrial complex and global warfare, right? Like there's mind says that, but on some level, you know that this was important. And to trust that is a very profound revolution. Because what would our society look like if we organized around that truth, that everything and therefore everyone is important, that every act is significant? Everything would be different.
Yeah, I've often suggested that while it's important to certainly teach the science of climate change and encourage young people to be engaged in kind of the politics around it, I'm very much supportive of those things. I also think that the real work of, if we're going to use the word environmentalism, the real work of environmentalism that might occur in a home or in a school with young people, with children, would be the work of actually, the primary work would be of teaching people how to live in relationship in a healthy way. To start with that kind of like thinking of ourselves in relationship with whatever's there in our home right around us, as opposed to leaping ahead to the big challenge, which is obviously important and has to be done. But I think that grounding that in the relationships that happen among each of us is really important.
And if you ask, like, okay, even if you say, okay, we got to deal with this big challenge first, which I don't agree with, by the way. I think that the nature of the climate crisis is different than the climate activism world believes. I don't think that we're facing necessarily global warming. I think we're facing climate derangement caused by the death or the weakening of Earth's organs and tissues, like forests, wetlands, soil, water, whales, fish, elephants, seabirds, seals, turtles, amphibians, insects. Oh my goodness. Like that's a key organ of Gaia.
Sure. Yeah. And, yeah.
You know, the like what neonicotinoid pesticides are doing to the insect world and like all these spraying campaigns. I mean, last year, or was it 2019, they sprayed my entire state for Zika. Anyway.
My neighborhood in Chicago was sprayed.
Yeah.
We tried to.
Yeah.
Fight it, but they
like, are you kidding me? Like, I mean, yeah. We could cut carbon emissions to zero, and if we keep destroying the organs, then Earth is still going to die. Anyway, that was a little detour, but what I want to say, yes. Okay, so you ask, why is this crisis happening? Say you do want to look at the big picture and work on the big picture first, but then how do you do that? The easy way is to find one thing that's an enemy and go to war against that. But soon you realize that the enemy, it includes ourselves, it includes our entire civilization. And to some extent, people can reduce their consumption, but a certain amount of consumption depends on one's circumstances. Like if you live in an American suburb, you have to drive, or you have to, you know, order stuff driven to your house. Like that's unavoidable. And now you could move out of your suburb to an eco-village, which means building an awful lot of eco-villages, which is a lot of materials. And then what about these derelict suburbs that would be left behind? And not only the economic infrastructure that compels a certain level of consumption, but then you, if you really ask, well, why are people in so many places, among the affluent at least, over-consuming? Why are they living these profligate lifestyles? Why? You know, once you get over blaming them for being greedy and you actually ask why with curiosity, the answer, at least the one I came to, is because in fact, despite the appearance of wealth, they are in a kind of poverty, a poverty of disconnection from community, a poverty of disconnection from their feelings, a poverty of disconnection from nature, a poverty of having not a strong sense of belonging. So if that doesn't change, the addictions, the consumption, the violence that comes from that, the war machine. If we didn't have a global war machine that's spending $2 or $3 trillion annually and is the largest polluter on the planet and occupies the intelligence and life force of so many tens of millions of young people, if we didn't have that and all that energy was devoted to ecological healing, everything would be different. And if we weren't spending so much of our blood and treasure on prisons and other kinds of conflict. I mean, the human creativity is unlimited. So if you really want to solve the ecological crisis, you have to solve the social crisis. You have to solve the spiritual crisis. All of these things go together. You can't skip any level and go straight just to the big picture and be the world's saving hero. We've tried that before.
It's being the hero is, it doesn't work on a small scale and it doesn't work on a big scale. So with that, let's take a quick break and then I want to come back and kind of dive into some of those areas, begin to reimagine about human experience. Our statement of intent. One, the planet and humanity are at a moment of crisis and opportunity and of transition. Two, because we are entering into an unknown future, imagination is paramount. Three, this moment requires new stories, new narratives, new creative works that express this reimagining. Four, we believe that these narratives must challenge and confront the injustices of our day. Five, the crisis of the moment is an educational crisis. That is, we must reimagine educational processes in order to reimagine our narratives. Six, we welcome educators, poets, philosophers, activists, and writers who are interested in reimagining ourselves and our relationship to the planet. Seven, reimagining is a place not so much to find quick answers or definitive solutions. Rather, it is a place to ask big questions, to explore possibilities, and to imagine a new world. You can find more about our work at www.reimaginingmagazine.com and more about our broader mission at www.chicagowisdomproject.org and www.baltimorewisdomproject.org. I'm joined today by Charles Eisenstein. We're talking about reimagining environmentalism. You know, before the break, Charles, we had talked about kind of like before we can think about fixing the environment and solving that problem, so to speak, we have to look at what are the underlying crises behind some of the behaviors that we see that are really destructive and really problematic, but people aren't necessarily doing them because they want to destroy the earth. So I want you to talk a little bit more about what you see as some of the like core spiritual or social crises that we're facing, and then maybe talk about what we can do about them.
Yeah. So it's not necessarily that before we can work on the ecological crisis, we have to, it's that sure. As we work on the ecological crisis, if we don't pay attention to its foundations, to its origin, then we're just going to be putting out fires forever without looking at the source of the heat. So I would say that the biggest problem, the biggest crisis facing civilization right now is polarization. It is the decoherence of society that has been intensifying over my lifetime, but especially over the last 4 or 5 years, where there's almost like no even communication or conversation going on between various poles. It's just a shouting match and and warfare, where even information has become an implement of the war, where different sides of various issues can't even agree on what constitutes a fact. And the level of distrust of the people for the government is I've never seen it to that extent in my lifetime. So why is this happening? Well, one thing is a basic pattern of our culture and beyond, I would say, of civilization as we know it, which is the diagnosis of essentially of a problem being caused by a perpetrator. So part of this pattern of thinking is, what's the cause of crime? It's those bad people that we call criminals. What's the source of corporate extraction? It's the greed of the executives and shareholders. Both left and right think in this way.
Yeah, right.
And what's the cause of that scumbag who did this, that, and the other thing to me? Well, it's because he's a scumbag, right? He's like, so because I wouldn't have done that if I were him. I'm better than he is. And the people who disagree with me, the Trump supporters, the anti-vaxxers, the this, the that, the other thing, whatever that label is for you, they are, why would they disagree with me, who is smart and good? It must be because they're evil and stupid. Mm-hmm. So this is like a basic form of judgment that is pervasive. And that is, it's a fundamental error. It's you could call it the fundamental attribution error. It's a misdiagnosis that keeps us always at war with each other. What we have to understand to heal that, to move beyond that, is that people do things as a function of their circumstances. It's not that they don't have choice, but if we don't understand the circumstances from which they are choosing, then we're blind. Then we don't know. We can't change those circumstances if we're not looking at them. So this requires, to see that requires a willingness to let go of being the righteous one, to let go of being the smarter, better, righter, more moral, more woke, more conscious, et cetera, person, and to recognize our fundamental brotherhood, sisterhood, siblinghood.
It's connected to the thing we were talking about earlier when we were talking about how do we teach younger people, not about the climate crisis as a subject, as a scientific subject, which is important again, but how do we teach young people how to be in relationship with each other? I was thinking to myself as you were talking, you sound like a marriage counselor, right? Like you're suggesting that we ought to not blame, but rather think about any issue that arises as in any relationship, right? We ought to think about how we both made that together. It's not that people don't do wrong things, and it's not that there aren't better or worse ideas, but to think about bad guys and good guys or blame and heroes is to deny the kind of fundamental entanglement we have with each other.
Yeah.
You described it as like a fundamental error, suggests that its polarization has been increasing throughout your lifetime, but really over the last 4 or 5 years, you've seen it intensify. It's clear that at least in the United States, but probably elsewhere as well, like you see like the intensity of this kind of polarization all over the world. What do you attribute it to?
On one level, it's what I said. It's a pattern of thinking that actually is at the core of racism, misogyny, it's dehumanization. To judge another person is to dehumanize them. It's to say that they're less, I wouldn't have done that if I were them, they're lesser in some key aspect of humanity. So that's part of it. But also like just another part of it is trauma. It's generations and generations and hundreds, thousands of years of injustice, of pain, of various kinds, of unfairness. You know, that people are angry for a good reason. There's a tremendous fury underneath the facade of society. It's just boiling beneath the surface. And this anger is very easily manipulated and channeled onto hate. It takes the vehicle of hate and rides that vehicle toward a solution that doesn't actually change anything. The solution being to kill or take down in some way those that are the targets of the hate. Martin Luther King spoke about this. You know, he said things like, you can kill the haters, but you can't kill the hate. And I think he was tapping on a very deep source of wisdom there.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of different kinds of trauma that one can experience. And I think that some of them are sort of obvious traumas that people experience. I think there's maybe more subtle trauma that many of us, particularly men, experience, I think, but it could be true across the board, the trauma of being alienated from our inner lives and our emotional lives and not being permitted to express our feelings and be comfortable with those feelings. It feels to me like that kind of trauma, which is certainly inherited through generations, which often leads to a great deal of anger, you know, mm-hmm. in the way we deal with the world.
Yeah, like grief denied often turns into anger.
Yeah, absolutely, right, yeah. And often it's anger is the only sort of emotion permitted for a lot of boys and men, I think. So it, mm-hmm. it becomes, you know, the only way, the kind of go-to response right. to certain situations.
And then we often get shamed for just be for anger, just as when we were little, we got shamed for tears. And sure. So then like that energy has nowhere to go, except it turns inward. It hollows us out from the inside. We become distant, cold, and then explosive.
Right, yeah. There's also this notion of competition, you know, that I see a lot. And I see it, I think it plays into some of what you're talking about in the public discourse. It seems to be often rather than a conversation, what I see a lot in the public discourse is a competition. And it almost goes back to the very beginning of our conversation when we spoke about language. And sometimes it becomes a competition to show that we can use the right way of talking about something, that we can, if you say the wrong thing on Twitter, you get attacked, right? That kind of public discourse that happens, mm-hmm. rather than being allowed or permitted to kind of have a conversation, a dialogue, and feel through things together. It feels like it's more of a competition to win the fight rather than have an actual conversation and dialogue.
Yeah.
I think back to the way I was taught about the environment and about ecology, and I was taught that like organisms are competing with each other, the survival of the fittest. That was the way it was sort of framed, which I think yes. said more about our civilization than an actual ecosystem.
Yeah, it's a projection of our circumstances onto nature. Not that there isn't competition in nature, but to see nature as primarily driven by competition
sure.
overlooks a lot of symbiosis, a lot of cooperation in nature. And so there's a lot we're not seeing when we do that. It's one of those things that is left out, that if we really took that in, it would totally change our relationship, not only to nature, but to each other as well. One reason that competition is seen as a virtue, and it is like glorified. If you hear a political candidate, they often talk about making America more competitive, making our school system more competitive. in a worldview of us versus them, competitiveness is a primary virtue. And so you can even look at this obsession with competition, which also takes form in American foreign policy. It's all about our adversaries, you know, and so mm-hmm. forth. Like, we see the world as necessarily composed of separate competing units. That whole worldview is an expression of our sense of self,
yeah,
our story of self.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's coming, you know, it's like we can't hold on to it anymore. Our consciousness is changing. On some level, we no longer resonate with that. And it's not that we should abolish competition. Competition, like most of what we want to move past, has a higher incarnation and an important purpose, which is the refinement of your gifts that are then turned toward a higher order purpose, a cooperative, co-creative purpose. Just as in nature, the phase of headlong competition in an immature ecosystem eventually phase shifts into a steady state dynamic, a dynamic steady state cooperative synergistic kind of development. And so humanity, as, or I would say civilization, because hunter-gatherers and indigenous people have not necessarily been in the frame of headlong competition, but civilization, I think, is going through now a similar phase shift. And so are we as individuals in our consciousness, as we become aware that our purpose here is not simply to maximize rational self-interest and to be as safe as possible, but in fact, to contribute to a happening that is beyond ourselves, a happening that we can sense on the horizon.
It's so easy to fall into the trap of thinking that this hyper-individualistic, competitive way of thinking about the self, as because it is in often the kind of default assumption that's made. It's easy to fall into the trap of thinking that has always been and in all contexts is the way of thinking. But in fact, in most human cultures, for the vast duration of human history, that's not the way people necessarily thought about their relationship to each other or to the larger world.
Yeah, there was certainly a lot of communitarianism. Like, life was very communal. And in many cultures, if you even just thought of yourself as existing, you would think of yourself with your family, with your clan. Existence wasn't an individual attribute. And you lived in an ongoing daily reality that what is good for those around you is good for you too.
Right.
Now, there was still competition among different tribes. And basically, another way to look at the evolution of humanity now is that we are trying to find a way to become one super organism and overcome right. this tribal history.
Right. Right. I mean, we do. And that is a challenge that we've sort of evolved culturally to think of ourselves in these very small contexts, right? In these small clans or tribes, as you refer to it. And that's been the context for most of human history is much smaller. And then we created stories, mythologies, cultures, created worlds that were relatively embedded in a relatively small amount. And now we're global. And the challenge is, how do we take that what was once thought of as a very local but holistic way of thinking of the world, how do we take that and think of it on a global scale? And I think there are ways to do that, but I don't think they can skip over the intimate relationships and the local as well. Mm-hmm. You know, with the little time we have left, I wanted to get into what I generally invite people to do at the end is offer them the opportunity to reimagine our subject. So getting back to this word environmentalism, which we've broken down a little bit, but I think it's worth considering still. How do you envision, what is your hope for a new kind of environmentalism in the future? What would you like to see happen? Unless you decide to scrap the term altogether. Sometimes people, by the end of the conversation, they're ready to get rid of it. What is your hope? I mean, in terms of like thinking about living in a healthy way on the planet, like what's your hope for the future?
So for one thing, it starts with a reimagining of humanity's purpose here. The old story was that we are here to transcend nature, to conquer one frontier after another, to become the lords of matter. and to impose human design, human intelligence onto a world that had none of its own. A new story would be something like, we are here to contribute to the ongoing development of life and beauty on Earth, to become a new part of ecology that extends life even further than before, that we are servants of life and that we hold life sacred. That is fundamental. How is that expressed? Like, yeah, I think that we should reduce carbon emissions. Even if global warming isn't happening, if you just look at the ecological havoc wrecked by oil rigs, oil spills, and fracking wells, and pipelines, and strip mines, and all of that extraction industry, on those grounds alone, we want to stop doing that. Even if it has nothing to do with our survival or our self-interest. You look at one of those landscapes, you look at the like Albertan tar sands with those gigantic toxic pools and the ruined forests, and you're like, no, 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 I don't agree with this. This is not worth it. So the next expression of environmentalism, I want to see that no and that urgency. For one thing, like, let's hold that central. And then let's apply it to all life and all places, whether or not they fit into carbon calculus. Like, what's the carbon contribution of sea turtles? I don't know. But what I do know is that they are part of a global marine ecosystem, which is itself a living being, which is part of the living being we call Earth, and that it is important. And not only is it important for Earth's survival, but it's important, the sea turtle is important because it's important, because we love it, because it's a being, because it is sacred. That kind of respect is, it has to be the core of any environmentalism that I want to be part of. And it then maybe is focused a lot more on the local than current save the world environmentalism is. And ironically, or paradoxically even, focusing on the local, focusing on life as sacred for its own sake, that actually ends up saving the world too.
Charles Eisenstein, thank you so much for being here with us today. Thank you for reimagining.
Thank you, Theodore.
The Reimagining Podcast with Theodore Richards is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated. Original music by Cosmos Ray. Sound engineering by Jim Qualick. Thank you for listening and for reimagining with us.